Welcome to Refreshing Reflections. I'm Sean Scott, and today I'm reading from the August 2019 issue of The Guidepost. Let's begin with our editor's note by Edward Grinnanen. Caregiving Cocker. I just returned from a trip to Israel with a group of Guidepost readers. Hi guys, hope everyone got home safe. We had a wonderful time visiting the iconic sites of the Holy Land. Just as enriching were the conversations we shared. There were several people on the trip in recovery who praised our series of articles on overcoming addiction. A number were veterans who liked our pieces focusing on the challenges of military families. But the one thing everyone had in common was caregiving. Whether for a parent, a child, a spouse, or even a pet, we all had something personal to share about the demands and rewards of caregiving. It was a universal point of reference and a place where we all leaned into our faith the most. And speaking of pets, we all shared a devotion to our animals as well. Which is why I am so happy about the caregiving article in this month's issue, which introduces you to a cat, a parrot, and a dog. Unique family, caregivers all. There was one such animal in my family, a crafty little cocker spaniel named Sally. She traveled with Julie and me one summer to visit my mom, who was in the early stages of dementia, but still able to live on her own. Sally and Mom were inseparable. Sally even going so far to sleep at the foot of Mom's bed every night. Then I noticed a peculiar phenomenon. We'd brought along a store of Sally's food, and it was being depleted at an alarming rate. I had my suspicions and took Sally aside. "What are you up to?" I asked. Sally looked away as dogs do when they've been nabbed red-pawed. "Who, me?" She had apparently convinced Mom that she had forgotten to feed her. Sally was getting at least 4 meals a day instead of her allotted 2, thanks to Mom's shaky memory. After I took control of the food, I figured Sally would revert to her mischievous self. But you know what? She became even more devoted to Mom. She barely left her side for the rest of the visit. And when they said goodbye, Mom cried. Sally had known Mom needed tenderness more than ever. Remember, if you are a caregiver, you are not alone. Visit guidepost.org/caregiving for support, information, and inspiring stories. Everyday Greatness, Carol Zamola Garci, by Marie Pack, editor. 12 years sober, 25-year breast cancer survivor, 77-year-old. Why not ride a bike all the way across the country? Who she is, Carol Zamola Garci, is a 77-year-old cyclist. Though biking since childhood, Carol went on her first long-distance ride, 500 miles, in 1994 for the American Lung Association after her mother, an avid cyclist, died of lung cancer. She loves that biking. It keeps her in shape, physically and spiritually. Carol started meditating and praying 12 years ago after joining Alcoholics Anonymous, and distance cycling helps her focus. "I'm praying while riding. I talk to God." What she does. Carol joined a group of 13 seniors for a cross-country trip from Florida to California. She was the oldest female member to complete the journey. An 81-year-old man biked partway, and a 75-year-old man completed the ride. There was one young man, Carol says. He was 59. The group biked 50 to 80 miles a day for 65 days between February and April of 2019. "I didn't know if I had the stamina for the whole trip," she says. "But at mile 1,000, I knew it was a done deal." Some trip highlights. Mardi Gras in Alabama, where the celebration actually started. singing American the Beautiful on the road, visiting relatives in Arizona, but nothing beat dipping her tires in the Pacific after 2,757 miles across 8 states. Why she does it. You never know what you can do unless you try, says Carol. She biked the northern border with the same organizers, Nancy and Ken Wright, in 2006. I had already done the northern tier, so I wanted to do the southern. Carol also raised money for several organizations, including breast cancer charities. Some people even handed her money on the road. I'm a 25-year breast cancer survivor, Carol says. It's going to be a generous donation. How she does it. Carol biked 150 miles a week in her hometown of Chicago to train for the ride and brought Boron Arm Care on the trip for muscle pain. I was using a lot of new muscles, she says. The journey wouldn't have been possible without the people who helped along the way. Carol's friend Dot, another group member, waited for her at crucial turns after Carol's odometer broke, making it difficult to follow Nancy's printed directions. Dot was my guiding light, Carol says. Another time, Carol and Dot took shelter from the rain on a couple's front porch. They insisted that we come inside and warm up at the fireplace. Carol says when Carol and Dot explained that they were seniors biking across the country, the couple's little boy looked up at them cheerfully and said, "We don't see this every day." How you can do it. Make safety your priority. She recommends getting a fluorescent vest, a comfortable helmet, an odometer and water bottle cages. Find a local bike route, good signage, and start small. Ride a mile or two a day, then three or four. Keep going. It has to be slow and fun, she says. If it's not fun, you're not going to want to do it. Spiritual Wealth by Doug Linham of Santa Fe, New Mexico. As a monk, he took a vow of poverty, but he learned that didn't mean money wasn't important. From monk to money manager. Not only is that the title of a book I've written, but it's pretty much my resume. For 20 years, I was a monk, and now I'm a partner at a wealth management company. Sound like two completely different callings. The irony of my life is that I joined a monastery in part to escape the world of finance. I ended up spending more time worrying about money than anyone. Right after graduating from college with a math and philosophy degree, I decided to enter a Benedictine monastery. I was searching for meaning in my life. I thought that if I was ever going to find it, a monastery would be the place. I'd replace the material things in my life with the spiritual. In the Benedictines, I discovered a remarkable community filled with loving kindness. Each day was rich with meaning and prayer. I was the junior monk by almost 30 years, so I was the lowest person in the pecking order. Just a happy grunt trying not to screw up. I assumed the senior monks knew about bookkeeping and managing a budget. Within a few years, it was clear that something was wrong with the community's finances. Desperately wrong. We all worked full time. I taught math at a private school, and we took in guests. But somehow, there wasn't enough money to pay the bills. Calls were coming in from creditors. These monks were actually getting dunned. So, I volunteered to take charge of the monastery's finances. What I discovered was that we were under an avalanche of debt. Not just a couple of missing payments. We were deep in the red. Our religious order had a commitment to self-sufficiency. How had we gotten into this mess? The brothers had clung to the hope that prayer alone could solve our problems. We viewed money as the root of all evil. Somehow, there was the trust that everything would work out for the best. But I knew you wouldn't just ignore the problem. Doing that would only make things worse. Trying to iron things out, I stumbled onto my current career. Not only did I help the brothers, but I started counseling some of our guests. In the process, I came up with a few rules about mammon for monks and everyone else. Prayer needs to lead to action. Giving everything to God doesn't mean dumping our responsibilities into His lap. God shows us how to live, but He can do the living for us. Praying for the bills to get paid without taking financial action is a guaranteed path to ruin. One of the hardest truths for the brothers to face was the reality that God was not going to bail them out. It didn't matter that we lived a life of love, service, and self-sacrifice, doing good in the world. Our creditors wanted their money with serious interest. I went to the bookstore and bought everything I could find on personal finance. The depth of my ignorance shocked me. I had grown up around money. My dad was a CEO, and my mom was a certified financial planner. But I hadn't learned much from them. After their divorce, my parents used money as a weapon, arguing about who was supposed to pay for what. At one point, they nearly defaulted on my college tuition. Having too much money seemed to be the root of the problem. So I took a vow of poverty, only to find out that having too little money was also a problem. Which leads me to my next rule. Develop a healthy relationship with money. No one can serve two masters. As Jesus said, either you will hate the one and love the other, or you will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. But here's the cool trick. You can make money serve God. When I look at the verses in the Bible about the dangers of loving money, it's the Greek word philargyria they use. That literally means love of silver. For a healthy relationship with money, think about the word agape, or divine love, instead. Selfless love devoted to the service of others. You don't have to hate money. Just use it and love it properly. It can help you put your values in action. To instill gratitude in my financial life, I started a practice of saying thanks every time I gave or received money, especially when writing a check to a worthy cause. It's hard to do when paying a bill, but it helps me be grateful that I can pay my bills. I also use this practice when I'm shopping. I want to be sure everything I pay aligns with my goals and values. I need to master money so that it doesn't become my master. Say a prayer every time you use money, and money will never come before God. Get help. Visitors to the monastery would pour out their troubles at our dinner table. Listening to the conversations, I realized that almost everyone who came with a spiritual problem also had a financial problem lurking in the background. I started working pro bono with guests to help solve their money problems. If they could afford a certified financial planner or a lawyer, I sent them to a professional. I took on the clients who were too poor to get attention from anybody in the industry. I wasn't good enough yet to charge anyone, but I was developing my skill set. Frequently, people would ask me to pray for them, to get relief from some money crisis. I always did, but I also insisted we make a budget. Look for a mentor to help you with your money problems. If you can afford it, hire a professional coach. If you are facing complex emotional issues, money often touches on our deepest insecurities. Talk to a therapist or counselor, or try a Debtors Anonymous meeting. For professional financial advice, make sure you are using a planner or advisor who is a fiduciary, someone legally required to act in your best interest. Have that difficult talk. Up was down for my parents when it came to money. The more we had, the tenser things became. They became experts in poor mouthing each other. I wore ratty shoes with holes in the sides all through middle school because it was too much trouble to ask for new ones. Any money spent on me, even an ice cream cone, felt like a huge burden. Why didn't we talk about money? Why didn't they? I'm not married, so I can't pretend to know all the answers to family issues, but I've learned a few things about resolving money conflicts. Talking frankly is essential. Schedule a conversation with your spouse when you are both well rested and relaxed. Share your gratitude first, then get to the hard stuff like what your goals are, how to make a budget, how to get out of the red. If you're in the red, watch your tone. Ask. Don't assume. Never lie. Stay on topic. And remember that you love each other. Money can blind us to love. If you get bogged down, start over and talk about your hopes and dreams. Try to build a game plan together. Sometimes discussions get so emotional, you need a timeout. That's totally normal. But before you step away from the conversation, commit to a specific time to reconvene. The money talk may be one of the best conversations you'll ever have. Build your financial literacy. Look up every financial word you don't know. Learning to speak finance may be slow going at first, and you might find yourself looking up the same words multiple times. But if you stick to it, the process pays off. I think of finance as a triangle, a little like the Holy Trinity. For a comfortable retirement, you need to do all three things: save, earn, and invest. It does no good to earn if you don't save, and the money you save, you need to invest. Sign up for reputable investment newsletters, blogs, and podcasts. They will give you a wide variety of tips and tricks and introduce you to words and ideas to help expand your financial literacy. Or else, work with a certified financial planner. Many employers offer this service to employees. Live below your means. One of my clients is a cafeteria worker in a private school making about $30,000 a year. Her husband works in construction, and they have two children. She immigrated to America as a young woman and is intimately familiar with the pain of poverty. She doesn't want that life anymore, especially for her children. So she budgets, saves, and invests carefully. At 35, she already has a solid six-figure retirement account. On her current trajectory, she will be in great shape at 65. By contrast, my CEO father, a high-income earner, didn't save much. With each promotion and pay raise, his lifestyle became increasingly lavish. He started out in an efficiency apartment, traded up to a stylish ranch home, and then to a three-story mansion on 15 acres. Where is he now? Back in a small efficiency apartment, living off Social Security. Watching him suffer through that transition has been hard. I joined the community of brothers for one reason. I felt unconditionally loved. That was worth sacrificing the world for. Even though they had to dig themselves out from under some poor financial decisions, the brothers always tried to love more. When I left the monastery to become a money manager, I wanted to continue doing that, because the ultimate goal of handling money well is to be able to give generously and help make the world a better, kinder, more loving place. Connected by Diane Stark of Brazil, Indiana. My widowed mother-in-law living right down the road. Sometimes it seemed much farther. I walked into my mother-in-law's house, as always, without knocking. My father-in-law, Larry, had died months earlier, but part of me still expected to find him in his recliner in the living room, watching the Waltons on TV. "Hello," I called out. "I didn't hear you come in," Judy said, coming down the hallway from her bedroom. Not her real bedroom, just the spare room she'd been sleeping in since Larry's passing. Larry and Judy had been married for 51 years. They'd had 9 children. 7 were still living. My husband Eric and I lived about a quarter mile away, so it was easy to pop in. But the past 2 years, ever since Larry had had several strokes, either Eric or I had been with Judy nearly constantly, helping with caregiving. His siblings had pitched in too. But with Larry gone, and despite my best intentions, it was sometimes days between visits. I glanced at the kitchen table where Judy's Bible sat opened to a favorite verse. Next to it was a box of photos Eric had brought up from the basement the night Larry died. We'd looked through them as a family, choosing some to display at the funeral. Eric and I had both offered to take the box back to the basement, but Judy always shook her head. She was only 73. I thought she would be okay on her own. Her quiet, can-do attitude had seen her through a lot over the years. I was sure she'd welcome the chance to get out of the house again whenever she wanted, to see friends or join a group at the senior center. But Judy hadn't done any of that. It was as if she'd lost her joy in life. Her grief compounded by loneliness. It broke my heart to see her like this. There are 7 siblings and 7 days in a week. I told Eric that evening. He's an engineer, so I know he'd appreciate having a system. Each sibling will take a day to call your mom or visit her. Then she won't be lonely. It's a good idea, Eric said. But it's not going to work. Everyone's busy. If we could send her a text saying we're thinking about her, the grandkids could get in on it too. Yeah, well, that's never going to happen either, I said. With 7 families and 13 teenagers or young adults among us, texting was our go-to way of communicating. When we were all caring for Larry, a family group text had been a lifesaver. That's when Eric got Judy a smartphone. But she kept getting confused and forgetting the instructions. Eventually, she gave the phone back and reverted to her old flip phone. She had no interest in texting. "Whatever happened to using your phone for actually talking," she'd say. I saw her point. There was no real reason we couldn't call Judy to tell her something, other than that we'd all gotten used to a different way of communicating. The truth was, it was as hard for us to change back as it was for her to try something new. Just as Eric predicted, my plan for a daily rotation never really got off the ground. Instead, we went on communicating through text and email, then had to remember to call Judy to keep her in the loop for any family get-together. If plans changed at the last minute, that meant another phone call. The bigger problem was that too often, Judy missed the everyday chatter of our lives. The kids' school projects, family snapshots, funny stories. Every few days, I checked in on her. But it only reminded me how disconnected she was from friends and family. How lonely she probably was. I couldn't fill her in on all the family news. But there had to be something I could do to involve her. some way of convincing her not to be afraid of technology. I prayed about it, but found no answers. Finally, I gave up trying. Eric, too. Then Eric's youngest sister, Cindy, announced her husband's job had transferred him to Amsterdam. They'd be in the Netherlands for at least 2 years. Days later, when Eric and I dropped by Cindy's, move was all Judy could talk about. We're all going to have to get international calling plan, she said. Goodness knows what that costs. It's not the only way, Eric said. There are apps, free ones. Judy stared at the floor. I've never used an app. I'll be happy to teach you, I offered. I'll think about it, she said. Not long after Cindy moved to Amsterdam, Eric's older sister got a new job in Texas. It was evident how much Judy missed her daughters. One day she said, what was that thing I can get on my phone that will help me talk to Cindy for free? I'm missing out on too much. I need to be more connected. I could hardly believe it. The very thing I'd prayed for. Another of Eric's sisters bought Judy a less complicated smartphone. Eric downloaded the WhatsApp messaging app for her moments later. She was talking to Cindy, the reception crystal clear. Judy couldn't stop smiling. When the call was over, Eric showed her how she could text using the app and even video chat. At first, she used it only if one of us was there to help her. Then one day, I took her to lunch. One of my friends uses WhatsApp, she said. She texts her grandkids with it. I think I might like to do that too. That's great, I said, resisting the urge to push her further. In God's time, I reminded myself. Judy had grown more active socially, too, joining a Bible study and going to lunch with friends. A few days later, my phone pinged with a text. Hi, it read. Judy. You sent me a text. I typed back. I sent one to everyone in my contact list. Nothing could hold Judy back after that. With the press of a key, she had someone to pass the time with. A connection that didn't replace a face-to-face meeting, yet offered an intimacy all its own. Soon, Judy wanted to tackle the laptop computer we kids had bought her for Christmas several years before. There's this pastor I like, she said. He sends out newsletters on email. I'd like to subscribe. Eric set up an email address for her and showed her how to find the pastor's website. On her own, Judy emailed a contractor about a home improvement project. A granddaughter taught her how to look for recipes on Pinterest. She's excited to learn how to shop online. But her first love is still messaging. Staying in the loop with children and grandchildren, friends from church, laughing at jokes, sharing recipes, extending birthday greetings or congratulations on a good report card. Sometimes it feels as if Judy is more in the loop than I am. And today, when I visit her, still without knocking, I see a different woman, happier, no longer lonely. She's back in her real bedroom, and the box of photos has been returned to a shelf in the basement. Her old Bible is still front and center. Loneliness is one of our society's greatest problems, and when your family member is suffering, the problem really hits home. Yet all my attempts to make Judy change failed. Only God could do that. Our immediate solution was technology we've all come to depend on. But the real breakthrough was helping my mother-in-law reconnect with her family and friends and with her life. Well, we are out of time. Thank you for listening. I'm Sean Scott. And until next time, may we all be refreshed.